This is a conspiracy. That's what this is.
One big damn conspiracy! And everyone's in on it!
I know what's going on.
Did IQs just drop sharply while I was away?
The person is smart. People are dumb, panicky, dangerous animals, and you know it.
Did you see the memo about this?
Just when I think you couldn't possibly be any dumber, you go and do something like this.
Don't you see what this means? This is it! This is the beginning of everything! I've been waiting for this all my life!
Welcome to episode 55 of Your Missing the Point podcast, where we discuss the weird, the wonderful, and the downright bizarre aspects of life, as we have conversations with people from all over the world. Today, I'm joined by a man known to many as the Southern Swami, the Enlightened Anglo, and the Maharaja of Melbourne. Let us welcome back the one and only Fozzie the Aussie. Welcome back, Fozzie.
Thank you, brother. What a title. I don't know if it's going to be able to get me like any like discounts at the bank if I get a mortgage or anything, but, you know.
Hey, brother, you know, Islamic banks are coming in and who knows what the future holds for that. So we'll just kind of see what happens.
I don't know what just happened.
You're back, man. It's okay.
I have no idea what just happened.
I was just saying, well, you know, Islamic banking is in the country. So, you know, maybe you can get some kind of Indian one going for yourself, mate.
Yeah,
picking up that culture pretty well.
Oh, dude, we should definitely get some like Hindu banking. Actually, I don't even think Hindus like actually like have a banking system. I think they just run off the Federal Reserve banking system, to be honest.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
As we have found out. Anyway, we had intended, this is like the third time is a charm type of a deal. We had promised the listeners we'd come back to talk about ancient India, the cultures of India, the religions, theology. But yet again, we've kind of deviated the conversation into something completely different. Last night, you're on a space and you brought up the ever so nostalgic childhood film called The Neverending Story, the 1984 cult classic, as it is known. But after a few bit of the discussions we've had, I think it's a much bigger conversation for this show. And we may or may not get to talk about India and politics and whatnot, but the nostalgic factor, the esoteric and the symbolic levels in this film are multi-layered. And I think it's probably going to take a big chunk of our time.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens. I mean, I think it will. But we'll see where we go with it, dude.
That's it. If it ends up being a three-hour podcast, so be it, man. Let's go.
That's
just it. See what happens.
That's it.
As I was saying to you before the show, I have a podcast that I'm a part of called Conspiracy Theatre 3000. Mm-hmm. And when I tend to break down films or I'm a guest on someone else's show and I break down films, I do a little thing that I've kind of coined as name magic. So what I've noticed with characters in tales, stories, plays, films, there seems to be etymological reference to the character and how they present over the film. It kind of, the name meaning dictates the character and who they are, or it inverts it in some ways. So I'm going to go to the two main characters of this story, the never-ending story. Bastian Bucks, a young little boy who, through his imagination, saves the world of Fantasia. But his name is very telling. Bastian is French in origin, meaning revered and venerable. Bucks, or Buksh, a Muslim surname or male given name, is derived from the Persian word bakish, meaning fate, destiny, or share. Therefore, we combine these. His name pre-tells the character's importance and the role of the story for him being a revered character. That's destiny is intertwined with the imaginative world of Fantasia. His fate is shared with all the creatures of that realm, whose very existence is reliant on Bastian's ability to keep them alive through the creative thoughts and prevent the nothing from destroying the realm.
Yeah, it was a wild film. I hadn't watched it since I must have been 6 years old, and I remembered nothing except the luck dragon. I forgot his name.
Balcor.
Balcor. But that's the only thing that I remember from the film. And it was like little snippets in my mind. And then I went on Amazon Prime the other day and I saw it. I'm like, oh, and it says it's like leaving Amazon Prime soon. I'm like, shit. Why not?
Gotta watch it.
Yeah, so I did, dude. And I, like, right from the get-go, look, maybe not the first scene, but, like, once he began reading the book, I'm like, oh, okay. And the moments sort of leading up to that was, like, quite an interesting one, this whole, like, obviously the mum's passed away, so it's just him and his father. And you know, the dad's trying to get him to like sort of mature up, but he has this weird thing about him. Like, I'm looking at how he's like behaving in the world. Like, you know, he tried to like butter his bread and he couldn't do it right. And all I was thinking to myself was like, oh, his mum used to do it, you know, and I'm starting to see little things and I'm like, oh, you know, maybe this kid's like autistic, you know, he looks like he sort of behaves in that sort of manner. And not obviously to take the piss or anything like that. But like once the tale got started of Fantasia,
It really kicks off, doesn't it? It just
dude.
goes to a next level.
Yeah,
Now,
yeah.
does that at all kind of freak you out that Bastian Bucks, the name given to this character, literally means a person who is revered and destined to do something? It's pre-written into the character before it even starts.
Yeah, well, dude, like it does blow my mind. I didn't know that. But it just like heightens the ending scenes.
The ending and the depth of this. Now,
Yeah,
this
yeah.
next character, my friend, this is going to tie back to a theory I have later on, which I think is going to differ from your idea of what this film presents and represents. But Carl Conrad Coriander, who's the gentleman who works at the bookstore, owns the bookstore.
Yep.
Carl is North Germanic male name meaning free man. Conrad is Germanic in origin meaning brave counsel. And coriander, similar in name to the coriander plant, which has been a symbol of health and vitality for millennia. Once again, the names line up with this character for their role and presence in the film, preempting the story's narrative. Carl becomes a free man when the curse of the never-ending story is lifted from him and
Oh.
transferred to Bastian. He tries to offer Bastian advice and counsel about his life and his troubles. He himself was used to feed the land of Fantasia, as a result, sucking away his life and vitality.
It makes sense now I think back over it, like, 'cause you know, he put the book under the newspaper and then he walked off into the other room and he's like watching. And you can see he has like a grin on his face, like he's happy that it's gone. Even
Take
though
it,
like
take
he
it.
wrote, yeah, even though like even though Bastian like left a note saying will return, like I will return this book. Yeah, dude, like from there, gosh, you know,
Well,
goes.
this is the crazy thing about it. What we got in the film of 1984 was literally the small cliff notes, if not the start of the book that was written. And to understand it, we need to have a look at multi-layers and multi-levels. So we'll get into a little bit of did you knows about the book and film in a moment. But personally, I see the never-ending story as being inspired by the likes of Nietzsche, Jung, and Crowley. It contains multiple levels of psychological, esoteric, and theological references. And overall, I can see it being perceived two ways. One, which I think was you initially last night, one highly positive, empowering for children and people, and the other being very negative, dark, and satanic, which in itself, having these two polar opposite ways of viewing it, is duality in itself.
Bro, I'm getting chills when you say that. Yeah, it's a dude, it's true, you know, like that thing that's seen like in I guess, you know, sort of you know, in sort of Hinduism would be, I mean, I guess it would be referred to as like dharma, which is like that sort of like one aspect is like righteous living, and then like the sort of multi-layered approach from the spiritual aspect of it. The other one is called sankalpa, which essentially represents like the intention put into something. So when the Empress is telling him at the end, like, you can have anything you want as long as you wish it into existence, bro, I'm like, oh,
Oh,
manifestation,
brother, hold
reality.
your
Yeah,
horses.
bro, I
It's going
was
to
like
get
losing
wild. This
it.
is either going to blow people's minds and make them want to watch it again or ruin their childhood forever.
I hope it
This is
doesn't.
going to
I
be.
hope it at least allows them to watch it again. 'Cause yeah, man, wow, what a film!
Absolutely. And before we get into it, let's get into some of the little did you know factoids about this film. Build some context around it and some deeper understanding. So here's the first, did you know? The Neverending Story is a fantasy novel by German writer Michael Ende, published in 1979. The 1984 film barely scratches the surface of the novel, as I said, and the second film was brought in to try and close up loose ends and plot holes, aligning it more closely to the source material. Michael Ende, the author, studied anthropology and had no children. He was married to a Japanese wife and loved all things Japanese, especially kabuki, which is the theater of Japan. He was a humanist and it bleeds forward into his work. His father was a surrealist and banned by the Nazi Party. His studio later was engulfed in flame during a firebombing, and he lived through and resisted the Nazis, supposedly. This is a quote by Michael Ende. There were thousands and thousands of forms of joy in the world, but all were essentially one and the same, namely the joy of being able to love, which is just a beautiful sentiment by this man. He probably lived through some of those dark, horrific times of his youth, but still somehow managed to see and find love in that. Michael Ende, the author of the original book, was so upset with the never-ending story's film portrayal and the his changed message, he sued the production company over it. Even director Steven Spielberg, who was called in at the 11th hour to assist in tailoring the film for American audiences, couldn't make the film's messaging match the book. In the end, his message was to embrace the power of imagination without getting lost in fantasy. And in the book, Baston became evil as he made more wishes. He wasn't tricked into wishing, and he wasn't lacking intelligence as a young man. So we see this in the second film. In the second film, where it kind of deviates away from the young, smart, quite softly spoken boy who's quite intelligent. And every time he uses his ability to manifest things and bring it into reality, he loses some of his real life memories. It starts to feed off him in a negative way. And as he does that in a nihilistic type of way and a idea of having what you want in a very greedy way, he makes more and more wishes to please his ego and himself. And it takes away from himself at the same time. And it ultimately creates him in turning into some kind of an anti-hero evil character.
I haven't seen. I didn't even know there was a second one, to be completely honest with you.
Oh,
Until,
brother, you are gonna have to
yeah,
watch
I'm
that
missing
now.
out. Wow. Oh man. Yeah, just that representation of like greed and karma and like the results of like what happens when you sort of try to just hoard everything. That goes into obviously many different faucets, irrespective. But wow, I didn't know. Cool. I'm gonna watch it. Fantastic.
Now, a lot of people would know the never-ending story either by Falcor himself, Atreyu, the Indian boy with his horse that dies in that very traumatic scene. I think a
Oh
lot of people of
man.
our generation kind of revert back to. But people remember the symbol either on the cover of the book or the VHS back in the day. And that symbol is the Orion, which sounds very similar to Aryan. And it's actually a very pivotal moment in the story, symbolizing magic, imagination, power of storytelling, and is central to the themes in that. So that interwoven kind of a snake symbol that you see on the book and in his pendant. A lot of people recognize this, but in somewhat ironically, the necklace itself is a symbol of the twin snakes biting each other's tail, which Bastion uses to fulfill all his wishes. He has like this totem. This symbol from the book is a reference to the Ouroboros. Now, that's a Gnostic symbol used in their magic that also represents somewhat of a yin and yang symbol, as well as life and death in the universe. It's an image that has been repeated in many subcultures and religions. Ende probably got this from Jung, who saw it as a mandala of alchemy, this all-encompassing thing of alchemy. But just for one moment, I've got to talk about this Ouroboros symbol, the Orion. I need to talk about the inscription that's written on it that you can actually see in the film.
Oh,
It's
really?
in German, tu was du willst, which to English roughly translate, do what you wish, or in other words, do what thou wilt, which is the basic tenet of Thelema, a religion and philosophy invented by the very satanic Mr. Crowley.
Yeah, that's crazy. Do that. What does it do? Do thou what wills?
Tu wus du willst, or do what you wish, which is a variation of do what thou wilt. So essentially, it's do what you want, the very Gnostic idea of the self and feeding the self and doing what you want to becoming more enlightened, instead of the idea of what you see in a lot of other faiths, which is about sacrifice and doing for others. It's more centralized in the ego trip.
Yeah, and that's like the vibe that I got from watching the film. Like, I didn't recognize that until I think the scene sort of leading up to when he has to get to when he goes through the gates.
And this is the thing, Atreyu, who's the almost like the avatar that he's reading about and bringing to life, that's not Bastion until the very end when Bastion enters it, which is quite interesting because what we've got is it's a multi-leveled story. It's almost like the Matrix in a lot of ways. You've got the awoken world, or the world that's real, that's happening to Bastion, and then you've got the world below that, which is the book of the Neverending Story, a Fantasia, the world that he brings to life with his imagination and his thoughts. So it's this multi-leveled thing where, like you said at the start, it seems to be one movie when it's just this little depressed little boy who's getting picked on by bullies, and then it flips the script as soon as we see this proud, strong, brave Indian boy named Atreyu who goes off on this quest.
Yeah. Wow. And while you're saying that, I'm like thinking about like the darknesses, like the nothing, sorry, the nothing. Dude, it's an incredible film. But yeah, sorry, I got distracted before in my own thoughts about like that particular scene, like when he comes into sort of when he comes into himself, when he realizes like this sort of and I'm talking about a trailer as opposed to but obviously like there's the interlink, but like that sort of action of like yeah, sort of looking inwards and sort of like wrestling with your consciousness. And that's something that that was one of my big takeaways, like when I was like watching this film. And as it just unfolds, like I'm like, bro, this is and that's the tweet that I tweeted because I was like, man, this film is like a per in my obviously this in my personal opinion, I'm not dismissing anything else in terms of like the symbology for sure, without a doubt. I don't think kids are gonna necessarily understand that, but like that's why like definitely an adult should watch it like now. Like if you watched it as a kid and you thought it was a great film, like watching it as an adult like really opened something up, dude. Like truly, I'm like, holy crap.
Well, this is that duality. Both can exist at the same time because,
Yeah.
darkness is an absence of light,
Yeah.
and light can't exist with total darkness. So the two have to exist at the same time. And it's almost quite telling that we get told the positive and the uplifting side when we're kids. We get that internalized message without realizing it. And then when we grow up, when you become quite crushed by the system and blackpilled, you start to see the dark that's hidden inside of it.
I think that's definitely a film that people are going to have to watch to prepare themselves for the end, mate.
Oh, dude, people have no idea. And for those people who haven't seen The Neverending Story, it's from 1984, for God's sake. So any spoilers are completely on you at this point. What I thought would be a good idea, Fozzie, because I think you're going to have a very different, optimistic view of what you've watched because you're very hyped and very nostalgic about it last night. Would you like to, let's just go from the start of the story, like you mentioned before, and get into it a little bit and tell me your thoughts on it, if we can, roughly scene by scene, just chronologically, if we can.
Yeah, okay. So we spoke about like the sort of first scene. So it opens up sort of scene set in the kitchen. Father's having sort of a trying to have a discussion with his son, expresses that, that their the wife, Bastion's mother had passed away. So it's just them two to sort of like, manage themselves. Father's, sort of dressed in like, sort of pinstripe suit. So businessman probably doesn't have a lot of time for the son. So he sort of puts forward this idea
Probably
that
represents capitalism, his
yeah,
father.
I would say so, yeah, for sure. And he sort of inputs this thing to Bastion that like, you're old enough now to do X, Y, and Z. And Bastion just accepts it, and while he's sort of accepting it, he's like he's trying to spread like butter on the bread, and he can't do it. Like I automatically assume that, like I said before, his mother did it. And then that sort of scene happens. This Bastion's been like, constantly late to school, he's like falling behind. And the dad goes on his way. Bastion makes his way to school. The bullies come along, throw him in the trash can. And subsequently, he was late. So he decides to. What does he do? Gosh. Oh, no, he ends up at the bookstore. Sorry, that's my apologies. So he's walking past and he sees the bookstore. He goes in, and I've forgotten the guy's name again, but the bookstore owner. he's reading this book, and he expresses, you know, Bastion's like interested, and he expresses to him that this book is unlike any other book that is in this store. So obviously, as a child, you know, like children have this like awe and wonder of like wanting to like touch everything. Someone says no, you want to do it. It's just a human condition. And subsequently, like, you know, the guy sort of leaves the book. He leaves it under the newspaper because he gets a phone call. And Bastion leaves a note saying, "Oh, we'll return this book." And he takes it and makes his way to school. And sort of fast forward, he's late for school. He goes up into the attic of the school, which, to be completely honest with you, I was a little bit, I'm like, I don't know about any schools that have attics that have got like these big, crazy, like werewolf sculptures in them and stuff like that. This is a weird looking attic. But yeah, so he goes up and he begins reading the book. And that's when, you know, the sort of like fantasia element of the movie, that sort of aspect of what I look at as beginning to understand your consciousness sort of begins. Like that's when he, you know, begins to sort of like read upon himself, read upon like this sort of this world.
It's very telling in this story when we do go into that world of Fantasia and we see Atreyu and the childlike Empress, and we're getting to meet all these characters. The biggest threat to this world, like you mentioned before, is called the Nothing. And the Nothing is very telling of what's happening in Bastion's life as well, because ultimately the Nothing is like despair and it's destroying the world. And he's suffering depression and despair for the loss of his mother. So the Nothing is basically it's a metaphor for depression and nihilism. Like we've got this force that represents a consuming despair of the people all around them who are losing not just their hopes and dreams, but their very meaning of existence in this world.
Yeah, man, it's wild. And you know, then God, I'm gonna have to watch it again. I just feel like I want to watch it again, dude. Like there's not many, I think there's maybe like two films in my life that I've wanted to like watch a second time. Shawshank Redemption's one of them, The Green Mile's the other one of them. They're the only two films I've ever wanted to watch a second time. This is like the third film I want to watch. Gosh,
Yeah,
yeah, then
what was your take on this childlike empress? We've got this almost omnipresent, omnipotent kind of god element in this world. It's a person that's never aged, a young girl. It almost kind of taps into that divine feminine aspect you see of a lot of ancient religions. What I found quite interesting, especially with the book, it gives her name. Bastion refers to her as the Moonchild. And the Moonchild was a name of a novel written by Aleister Crowley again. So
Oh,
we get
okay.
connections to him. It was literally a masturbatory, ego-driven retelling of his battle within the Cult of the Golden Dawn, where he demonized his rivals, including W.B. Yeats. Both Crowley and Endy paint a benevolent universal force of good as a feminine energy, contrary to Crowley's male god upbringing. This was kind of reframing his blame on everything on Eve tendencies to see women as less divine than men. The scene where Bastion is handed the seed of creation happens in a garden that calls back to the Garden of Eden, that Eve and Adam narrative is completely flipped on its head. And that's a scene from the book and what you see in the second film as well. It's quite interesting that. And I only came to this the other day when I was looking at some early German history that I've been looking at, that the childlike empress looks very similar to the young Aryan girls used by Maria Orsic in the Vril Society of the early 1930s Germany.
See, I was, it's interesting because I was getting, my mind was focusing on what she was wearing as her headdress, and where the sort of central piece of the headdress was resting was like right on
The
where
third
pineal
eye.
gland, the third eye, you
Ooh.
know. And then obviously, like for me, you know, I see like similar notes, so like in some traditional dress forms for specific ceremonies and worship and ritual in India. Like they wear very, very similar things that do represent this idea of like sort of like a cleansing and a renew, like a rebirth of something. And that's what like, and I'm going to apologize if I get any of this thing wrong to my friend Himanshu, but from my understanding, from the many, many hours of conversations that we've had and my own personal experiences, like sort of delving into this, the divine feminine is sort of has this representation as like bolstering the divine masculine. Like they have to both sort of work in tandem. Like you can't, in order to achieve like the ultimate goal of whatever it is that like in my mind that you want to achieve dreams, goals, what have you. The only way that's like completely foreseeable, in my personal opinion, is with a feminine partner, like a female partner.
Right? Well, it's the perfect duality of man.
Correct.
And man in general. Man correct. Cannot exist without woman.
Yeah. It wasn't just Adam in the garden. It wasn't just Adam in the garden. No. Like, it wasn't just, you know, just dancing around, tossing himself off or anything like that. So, you know, you need both. And I think that's that the way that she's portrayed is like the perfect portrayal. Also on that multi-level between, like, you know, if a child wants to watch it. And that's why I said what I said, because, you know, obviously, like, yeah, there is an interaction between a male and female. And I'm glad that that movie doesn't, like, sort of propagate anything like that. You know, obviously, you know, in modern society, it's a bit different. I don't need to go and see fucking 13-year-olds like twerking and shit to like fucking ghetto rap music. I know I'm deviating off, but like,
no, you're hitting the point though. You're hitting the idea that modern day wokeist films, they push the divine feminine and push away the divine masculine.
Warp it. They warp it.
They invert it. Yeah, they invert it to the point where, like, we saw in the 80s with the action hero movies, we had the divine masculine, but they always had the divine feminine character to balance them out.
Correct.
To keep them balanced, to keep them grounded.
Yep.
Whereas in these modern day takes, it's all about the ego-driven, strong woman who doesn't need no man. It poisons the well of it. Yeah. It's quite ironic that we actually see that in early Christianity when Catholicism took over the church and built the church.
Yep.
The Trinity in itself is the divine masculine and the divine feminine inside of it. Which many Christians don't like to acknowledge, but it does exist within the Trinity.
Yeah. Like, it's, you know, not to, like, obviously go too far off the line, but yeah, for sure. Like, you know, if we look at Mary, like, obviously, you know, I don't need to go into any sort of dialectics about fucking sexual relationships or anything like that. Just Mary as a character, an individual character, and Jesus as an individual character. They both have to play a part in like the sort of like ultimate teachings. And it just so happens, like, that's why, like, Orthodox and, like, you know, sort of like what's it called, apolyistic, like Armenian, like, sort of,
yeah
it's all part of that sort of Orthodox. Like, they see obviously Mary as divine. Mm-hmm. Like, they do worship to Mary as well as Jesus. Obviously in Roman Catholic it's a little bit different, but whatever, man. Like, you know, what do they say? Different snakes, different shakes, or something like that.
Different strokes for different folks.
That's the one. yeah, but anyway, so where were we? So Bastion,
he's reading the story now. We've kind of gone into the world, and we see that the nothing is threatening Fantasia, and a hero kind of steps out and presents himself to try and go on a quest to save the world, which is our boy Atreyu, which looks very similar to Bastion, that Avatar type of a scene. It's almost the character that Bastion wishes he could be, the boy he thinks he should be, brave, strong, in the face of adversity.
Yeah. It was, oh, man. That scene with the scene in the council when, like, all, like, the leaders across Fantasia, like, gather. And they have this big discussion, and I don't know if there was any esoteric symbolism in there, but like the three-headed characters, I was like, I was getting something off of there.
Dude, the stone people, the stone giants.
Yeah.
Nephilim, anybody? Just a little bit of Nephilim in that one?
Oh, dude. Man, there was there's so much symbolism in it. Fuck. Now we're having the discussion where I can get this, like, these thoughts out. My God.
Even like the divine oracle, which he's sent to go and he has to go. They give him the task of finding the divine oracle, this all-knowing being in this world that can give him information of how to stop the nothing, right?
Yes, that's right.
And what is this entity? He goes through this quest, and I'm kind of jumping all over the place here, but anyway.
Yeah.
He finds this divine oracle. It ends up being a giant turtle, which just reminds me very much of the Discworld analogy of the world is a disc floating on the back of a turtle floating through space.
Yep. It's wild, dude.
Like, very telling.
I was taking notes from, like, Hinduism with, like, turtles and Matsurya, like, this, like, first avatar of Vishnu, and, like, this thing that is, like, ever there, ever present, and that is, like, water, that is life. There's like, these multi-layered sort of approaches in it, but Dude, the turtle having like an allergy to what'd she say she had an allergy to? It was to do with the Atreya. It was because he was there. Oh, what was it? Oh gosh, I don't remember it now. Do you remember it?
Oh, I can't. I've not watched
She
this in
was
a long time.
she was allergic to Atreya because something to do with
Was it
something to do
optimism or
with
hope or
it
something?
was something like that, like something to do with like that confidence building, like comes with like that. And then like, yeah, anyway, she sneezed a few times.
Please help me. You said you knew the
answer. You're tired of sneezing. Go away. Nothing matters.
That's not true. If it didn't really matter to you, you could tell me.
Clever boy.
Tell me, please!
We don't know. But you can ask the Southern Oracle.
How can I get there?
You can't. It's 10,000 miles away.
But that's so far.
That's right. Forget it.
And how manically depressed was that turtle? It ultimately came down to what do you do in the face of the nothing? How do we fight it? Oh, you die. You just accept it and die. And that's a kid's film. You
Yeah,
just
and you know
accept
what's
it and
interesting as
die,
well?
right?
You know what's interesting as well? It was like this layered thing because that's why that the swamp that she was in was called like the swamp of sadness.
And sorry, yeah,
And
sadness and
she was
sorry.
a and she was a miserable bitch. She was
Yeah.
an she was a fucking miserable bitch anyway. yeah, so she points Atreya in the direction. We did. Yeah. Anyway, Atreya's horse. I forgot the horse's name. The horse dies, which was really sad. Like, yeah, that was a bit rough, to be completely honest with you. I think even for a kid, like, if even if the kid's like maybe like 7 or 8, might be like, oh, you know, like it's rough
It,
because
well, you don't tend to see that in kids' films anymore. You might see a 13-year-old twerking, but you don't see like
well.
animals die like that anymore.
Well, you don't see that level of screen production anymore either, where
No, we
every,
do not.
like, the screen production's completely different. Like, if, like, don't
Films
think,
were a work of art, Fozzie. They every
yeah,
shot had
100%.
meaning, everything in the scene had meaning to drive the story.
100%,
Now
dude.
it's just rinsed, regurgitated, relabeled, rehashed crap that is so unimaginative, which almost brings me to the idea that all of Hollywood is evil because evil cannot create, it can only reinvent. And we're seeing a big lack of creativity these days.
Oh yeah, it's because you know the marketing teams, mate, the market analysis, like, oh, what does the market want? Well, based on the analysis of X, Y, and Z, this is the best approach for the particular type of movie we're going to create. We're going to, and you know, then you got to layer in, it has to be progressive, it has to be this, it has to be that,
Need
and
two trans characters and a
well,
really dumb straight male as the father who does nothing.
you're already making a box, but then you're regulating that box and slowly making it smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. So like the creative process, the creative juices become less and less and less. Therefore, like you end up with like, dude, there's so many films that are, man, there's hundreds of films that just get punched out every single year. I don't know any of their names. Like they're just, I don't even know. Like to me, I'm just like, bro, is Hollywood seriously like, they must be making so much money. There's no possible way that they could be making money off of half of these films. And even if they are, like, what is it? $1 million? Like,
Yeah,
some of these films are garbage,
it's
bro.
got to be money laundering and just like washing money, dirty money at this point. It's that far gone.
I wouldn't be surprised, dude. Like, I don't understand. Yeah, there's films that do come out that people go and see. You know, obviously Disney's got its audience. There's always, Marvel's been around for so fucking long, it's not going anywhere. Right, same thing with DC. People grew up on Batman, people grew up on Iron Man, the Hulk, whatever. Like that's gonna stay there. But just, you know, I go look when I like torrent films. Like ASIO, don't fucking get me for this, but anyway, like my sort of, you know, when I like torrent, when I go look at some torrents and stuff, man, it's just garbage. Like
It
most of it's
is.
just garbage.
And you nailed that analogy of the box shrinking, getting smaller. We even saw that in the likes of Marvel recently, where it was really strong in the first and second wave. And as soon as it started to become more woke and have more of those elements, and the box was getting smaller and suffocating the creativity that was Marvel in its in its infancy. And we don't see that in the whole, one of the subcontexts of this film is that creativity is only limited by your mind and your imagination. And it's forever expanding. It's never ending as long as you've always got the power to think.
Yeah, but it comes with challenges, like trying to pass those gates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's like, I think that's like the sort of next thing that happens. So there's this spot. You'd have to remind me, to be honest. But so the oracle, the tortoise has pointed him in the direction that he has to travel. Where my brain draws is when he meets like the elderly couple after Balcor takes him. And then before that, it is...
Well, he has to go to a Sphinx, isn't it? He has to face the Sphinx for one of the trials later on.
Well, that's the second... The second Sphinx ends up being the Empress, though, isn't it?
I believe so. But this is the interesting thing, is that it's presenting... Like, the trials that he goes through, it's almost playing out the story that people who have no hope are easy to control. And I think that the characters in this realm of Fantasia, they are lacking hope because everything's being destroyed. They don't see a possible good outcome. Bastion, in some ways, probably feeding that because he sees no hope in his life at that point. And it doesn't take a doctorate in philosophy to realize that nihilism is a recipe for unhappiness.
Mm.
Like, Friedrich Nietzsche warned about the dangers of nihilism more than a century ago. Nietzsche may have famously declared God dead in 1882, but the philosopher worried that God's metaphorical death left a serious chasm in the universe and how to find meaning in the world with suffering existing in it. And what does that mean for our characters? The characters, they're going through this nihilistic thing. Nothing matters to them because they don't have a person anymore who's imagining the world for them. They almost need that person to feed on, air quotes, through their imagination as some kind of a god vessel to produce for them.
Yeah, that kind of plays into my thoughts about how, like, these things that Bastion was reading is influencing the real world as well.
Exactly. Is there a world above him then? Is that multi-levered?
Yeah, dude, that's wild. Mm.
And this is where Nietzsche kind of talks about his solution as the problem was for man not to treat his very existence, was to treat his very existence rather as a work of art, which will create value and meaning in life. Now, generally, this is good advice for anyone. A life is a gift, and it should be lived and treated as a work of art. But at the same time, if you lack that presence of God, like today, for example, we can go from nihilism into consumerism, into crony capitalism, into a world where people are so fixated on the physical and the self, it takes away God from society and it gets replaced by the government. And the government becomes a big, all omnipresent sky daddy that tells you what you can and can't do. It interferes in your life. And it in itself ends up creating a system of depression. It's a self-feeding cycle loop.
If you lose God in like the art, well, you're not going to have those Extinction Rebellion guys go and put tomato sauce on your art because it's probably going to be garbage.
Well, look at the art they target, though. They target art that was pre-industrial. That was pre-bastardization.
Mm.
Like, look at architecture. Architecture was beautiful. It was ornate. Cornices. The guttering even. Windows. Everything was precise. There was love. There was imagination in it. You look at brutalism today in architecture. Squares, straight angles, flat colors. It takes away the soul from the artistic form.
Yeah, oh, for sure, dude. Like, everything wants to go to, like, as... and. Obviously, there's still like geometry involved, but it's not the same to what it used to be. Like, dude, you look at some of like the old churches, like, you know, from the Dark Ages. You look at, you know,
the bells, frequencies, brother. Well,
we got rid of all our bells because of World War I and World War II. There's no more bells left. Hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of bells just turned into bullets. Yeah. Turned into bullets that got like just anyway, like it's just, it's, yeah, that's, yeah, bells are very sacred, man. That's yeah. When I think about these things and these forces that have played out in our past, it really it really makes me question the morality of what, or makes me question, like, sort of how humans are so comfortable with skewing their own morality that just like impacts so many people. But I know
To our
money.
own to our own detriment as well. People, they would gladly sell aspects of their soul for the physical wealth or the material.
It's just business, baby. It's just business, baby. That's all it is.
Forgive me because I get mixed up with the book on this as well because I've read it quite a few times. That there's a character called Gamork who's this physical flesh and blood creature that's sent on behalf of the nothing to try and
Oh,
kill Atreyu.
that's right. That's the wolf in the
Yes.
movie. Yeah, dude. Man, I had such a takeaway from that. That was like, the way I sort of interpreted Gamork was your own wolf in yourself. That sort of like warrior within that thing that like allows you to keep driving forward. And for Atreya, that was like his sort of, I guess that was kind of not really his ultimate challenge, but the challenge to sort of like overcome oneself in a dire situation.
And find his own self-worth. It's very telling that
Correct.
Atreyu's and the characters that he's from, the tribes in the books, are based on Native Americans. And the wolf for Gamork is based on like the spirit animal of internalized spirit of Native Americans, which is quite interesting because often you hear people who are suffering from drug dependency, alcohol, depression, cultural fatigue issues. There's two dogs or two wolves fighting within them. And they can't come to it to odds with themselves. They can't identify themselves. And what we see here is we see Atreyu ultimately fighting one side of himself throughout this
Yeah,
film.
dude, what a man, I'm just blown away that this film is like something that, like, man, there's not a lot of people that have seen it. I was
No,
talking with some
not at all.
talking with some Indian brothers and sisters. They got no idea. I asked my missus, I'm like, hey
Not
babe,
enough
have you seen this film?
dancing, mate. Not enough
Not
dancing.
well, true, guess there's not enough dancing, but like, this is a mate, for any of
Indians
my
would
Indian, they'd love this.
watch this and go, that's one of our stories.
Yeah, oh, for sure, bro, I would not be surprised. I'm gonna have a conversation with a mate of mine. Shout out, his Twitter handles, or his Twitter name's Duke of the Diaspora. He's from Canada, but he like works in like sort of promoting like unison amongst like Hindu communities, whether abroad or in India. And he does a pretty good job at that. He gets a lot of flack from other communities, but anyway, conversation for another day. Yeah, so it definitely does. So he overcomes it. Gamork, after a long conversation that those two have about the idea, and so that's why I sort of took that away, is like the sort of idea of being comfortable with your self-worth and being able to like sort of carry on and fight for yourself. I mean, that as I said, that was my takeaways.
The conversation is quite telling in that as well. So Gamork, who's been sent after Atreyu, doesn't know his who he is, has been sent to kill him. Atreyu asks him why he would do such thing. Why would he work for the nothing to destroy the world he exists in? And Gamork says, because people who have no hopes are easily controlled. And
That's
whoever has the
right.
control has the power. God, that's not telling of governments today, the
That's
ruling
right.
class. It's just
Yeah,
so
dude.
spot on. So the film is telling us that there are forces in this world who want people to be in despair and that people are weak. And that when people are dependent and hopeless, aka people in socialist systems reliant on the system, that they are without hope and without dreams and are easier to control, and that people who are easily controlled pose no threat to those that are in power. If you're feeding at the coffers of the government, you will not rebel. There's a whole handful of postmodern philosophies, nihilism, pessimism, materialism, and chief amongst those, they are destroying the world as we can see it. Because they're destroying the meaning of life, what it means to be human. And the most terrifying thing Atreyu faces in Fantasia is that Sphinx that we spoke about before, who we're told will strike anyone down who tries to pass who does not feel their own worth, which is super telling of a world that was later to come from the 80s, in which it's parallel to ours today, ironically, where we have super high records of suicide and depression across the West.
Yeah, man. Fucking nuts. But he overcame it.
Yeah, he had the power to beat despair, and that exists in all of us, which is always a really good spot to recognize, and recognize that life is a gift worthy of being treated as that work of art.
After he saw what had happened as well. So there was a knight of riding on a horse, and this knight was draped in like a sort of very medieval style, like draping, completely covered head to toe.
Very rich, elegant knight, by the way. Yeah, all the like trappings of a nobleman.
Green silken trappings. Oh, yeah, yeah. And he ends up like trotting through on the horse and the eyes of the Sphinx. So the two Sphinxes, they sit against the walls of a canyon, facing one another. And if you're not worthy of, what is it? How does it describe like that? If there's not like a worth of like a sense of self worth, or a certain level of sense of self worth, the Sphinxes will destroy you. So Atreus bear witnesses to this with the knight that just goes through. But even still, even despite that, he carries on and he gets through. And the couple,
even with that seed of self-doubt already there and seeing someone's destruction, that is an ultimate thing to overcome, to recognize your own worth in the face of ultimate defeat.
Oh, dude, it was fucking wild, man. What a film.
And just a kid's book, just a kid's movie. It's definitely not Winnie the Pooh, is it?
No.
It's not C-Spot Run. Here is Spot. C-Spot Run. Run, Spot, Run. Go, Spot, Run.
See, I think like Winnie the Pooh just like promotes obesity. He's just always hungry. He's like, just keep eating sugar, mate. Just keep consuming sugar.
It's almost like a bear and twink thing too, because he lives with Piglet, and that's a kind of homoerotic kind of thing there, right? With honeypots.
Even the sort of style the Piglet looks, it kind of looks like he's wearing, imagine a gimp suit, but if it was pink. He actually kind of looks like, because it's got like these particular lines on the up.
Dude, whether it is destroyed, the never ending story of people, we better not destroy.
Oh, no. Pooh. It's too late. My Winnie the Pooh. My Winnie the Pooh. It's done.
Oh, bother.
It's done.
Oh, it's over.
He gets up to the second Sphinx. And which ends up being the Empress. But having a conversation about he has to go to a certain place. Oh, that's right. He has to fight. So that's right. So when he gets to the second Sphinx, so the first two Sphinxes are like gold laid. The next two Sphinxes have this like cobalt, like crystal blue looking, like sort of look to it. It's very, very intricate. And says to him that he has to find a human child. And he goes, he doesn't know what it is. He's got no other, like Atreus got no clue, never heard the term human in his life. How do I find it? And I believe that the Empress explains to him, like you will find it. Like it's inevitable that you will find it, but like you have to find it yourself or something like that. And he's all flustered. He's like, no, this can't be like, you know, on. Now here I go again. You know, like it took me ages to get here. Now I've got to go.
My horse is dead and I've got to go back. Correct. Now. Come on.
Now I've got to go back. But, you know, luckily Balcor. Luckily is his name Balcor?
Falcor.
Sorry. And Falcor's there, like, you know.
A million 80s meta nerds just screamed your name in anger.
I'm sure
that Balcor? No!
No! I didn't grow up in the 80s. I apologize. So he goes with Falcor, and the nothingness ends up taking over, and so there's no more Fantasia by this stage is in complete tatters. So like imagine like if the planet blew up and has like bits of like, you know, rock sort of strewn throughout the space, just like floating. So it has that. I didn't see, I was like kind of looking for it. I was kind of see if there was anything on any of these rocks that like had something, like either some symbology or a character or something like that. I didn't see anything like that. But then of course like they find the Empress's tower. It's this big, beautiful, and you know, it's interesting. I will actually tell you one thing where it does, in my mind, rep. I don't know about you if there's any symbology behind the structure of the tower, but a Shiva Lingam in Hinduism is a cylindrical object that like is round on the top. The Shiva Lingam actually represents light, and like what is in that permeates light, and that object that the Empress, that castle, that tower. It looks so much like it that when I saw it, I'm like, holy fuck. Like, I thought I was like, did God like show me that? Did God just show me that, like, fucking, you know, the never ending stories on Amazon Prime and I should check it out? Like, cause I was like I was having these weird, like, little synchronistic things. Call me crazy, but yeah.
I say it's called the Ivory Tower in the book. And it's that's like, right. Like you said, this golden kind of tower that looks very phallic in a lot of ways, also.
Yeah.
And I can't help, this is my bias as a Christian, and of course I'll say that. A tower of light, if we go back to Tammuz, who is the reincarnated version or bastardized version of Christ from Baal, Tammuz is known for building a tower. There's a Tower of Babel associated with that, this tower that builds up into the heavens. And if it's an inverted idea of that, a tower of light would be a tower that the Antichrist or Lucifer builds because he is the angel of light.
But then we've got to go to Jupiter as well. Because anytime like Lucifer gets involved, my brain just goes like, planets. Like, I can't help myself now. It's like almost like it's a knee jerk reaction. So like, and this is, I think this is why like some of the Christian community don't really like me all that much, because I constantly like anytime like they'll try to mention, you know, the devils are not obviously, I'm obviously paraphrasing conversations. I'm not going to, you know, don't have the ability to pull out all these little bits and pieces, but this idea that like, you know, Satan's there, like, you know, watch out, the Lucifer's there, like, watch out. I'm like, yes, Jupiter is there. I don't know if we have to watch out, but it's certainly there.
Well, this is the thing. I'm a Christian that questions a lot of this stuff because I've got this conspiracy and history background before finding my faith. So I always question and pull those parts apart and try to understand it. And I personally don't think the Bible in its entirety is the complete answer, because the Bible, as we know it, is written by man. So there's going to be loopholes. There's going to be translational errors.
Absolutely.
There's going to be propaganda hidden within it. So I think that, like all things, there's a scarica truth, and somewhere between all these counter points, they converge to one element of truth. And there's a mention that the angels were bound within the waters below as they are above. And if we think of it as the domed version of a flat earth, the waters above are what we used to create the flood. So we have angels imprisoned within the waters above. If Jupiter is up there, Jupiter very well could be a bound angel as a star. According
Certainly
to the
good.
Theological.
Certainly good, man. Like this, I don't know, like, you know, occasionally I'll like entertain myself with like going and having a chat with, like, there's a guy that's on Twitter. His name's Sacred, but it's all with like weird, like cool little characters. And he's like a full on flat earther, but he's the only flat earther that I'll like actually sit and listen to, because he genuinely goes through the mathematics of what he deems to be inaccurate. And there's some things that he has said that like have always made me question, and he spoke about, and I didn't even know what this term was until I listened into one of his Twitter spaces, was the firmament. Like, it wasn't, I guess I had heard the word in the past, but I had no like sort of registry of what it had meant in this particular regard, like when it comes to like flat earth theory and whatnot. And it's like beyond the firmament is like, you know, like, could it just be liquid, you know, like, it, like, because
the oceans of space, Fozzie?
Yeah, dude, man, like, you know, even I think to myself, like, these floods, you know, these monster floods that have happened in history, you know, like, could they have happened from like a massive asteroidal strike? It's possible. It's certainly possible. The meteors that have hit in the past, but like in the sort of more recent times, I'm not too sure. Like, you know, we have this idea of like global floods and obviously these global myths, but like how they sort of begun. Wow. Like maybe if you are like a believer in that firmament theory and like there is like actual something, like maybe that played a role in all of this. You know, we don't know, obviously.
We absolutely no don't.
No one wants to tell the truth because all the governments around the world like are just like, oh, we'll do our own things, but we kind of work in tandem, but neither of us will tell the truth. And then you've got the Vatican that's got all this. And then you got like every other like sort of, well, I'm not going to say every other religious organization, but you know what I mean. Like there's a lot.
Although the institutions of religion.
Correct. Yes. Correct. The institutions just sort of keep them like sort of as gated secrets. And I understand why, but like at the same time.
See, I kind of come at it this way. I edge definitely more to a flat earth perspective now after speaking to people, particularly a lot of American friends in podcasting who are very much on that. They present very, very great cases that I don't think the mainstream science can fully dismiss. Yep. But I personally, I can't fit my mind or my thinking to back any one idea if I can't see it for myself.
Yeah, well,
unless I go up there in SpaceX or something else and I can see that it's a flat plane, or unless we go down, I can't completely back something, but I can say I'm definitely edging towards that idea.
See, I'm a big hollow earth guy. I'm like,
that's
really
it can exist as well. Think a dome with an ice cream cone below and you tunnel into the ice cream cone.
Bro, when you just think about how big the planet is, right? Like, I don't think most people realize, like they see on paper, like, you know, 26,000 kilometers in diameter or something. Personally, I think that's bullshit. I think 26,000 kilometers in diameter is bullshit. I think it's much bigger than that.
Too small.
I think that's way too small. I think it's way bigger than 26,000 fucking like kilometers in diameter. No fucking way. But like this idea that like, you know, we're so small. Like what's below us? Like we don't know. Like no one, even geologists don't truly know. Like it's the whole idea. It's all guesstimate. Like there's nothing, there's no absolute confirmation that says, in the middle of this planet is an iron, a magma or a liquid iron core that is turning. How the fuck is that turning? Oh, magnets are playing place.
Gravity, okay. Magnets.
Okay, but now like now we've got this extra thing that's been happening with the poles shifting. And the poles shifting narrow out that idea that in the center of the Earth is a big liquid ball of iron that is dictating the nature of magnetism. When it's I can't personally believe that, even, but as I said, you know, we've spoken on Twitter Space, like, you know, not to go off too far off the track, which we already have because we're idiots,
we're now on flat earth and we need to try and bring that back to never-ending conversation.
I know this podcast, oh my god.
But I'll quickly, I'm just going to tap into what you're saying because I'm going to recently, there's been detectable impacts of the operation of CERN when they switch it on and the spinning of the core within the Earth. They supposedly saw, through modern science, that when they switched it on the last time, it slowed down the spinning of the core to a measurable effect. I'm going to let you marinate on that. Let's try and bring it back to the never-ending story.
Yeah, that's going to take me, I'd probably say a few months to... Because this one's up. Thank you. I did not know that. Thank you. Wow. So he goes into the shivalingam.
The giant penis.
So he goes in to the ivory tower. He meets the empress, and so he gets to the empress, and the empress explains to him that he has had the human child with him all this time, because he's like flustered. He's trying to figure out, like, you know, she's sort of giving him riddles and like sort of sacred truths, but he's sort of wrapping his head around it. He's not really understanding. And as he still can't understand, at the same time, Bastion also can't understand. And while both of them have this interlinking through Bastion reading the book, the world, like, the sort of world within the ivory tower, which is like sort of like last bastion of hope, the last bastion of goodness.
And Bastion comes into it. The last bastion of hope. Yeah, that wordplay.
Yeah. It begins to like have like tectonic activity behave. So like, bits of the ceiling start to fall off and like there's earthquakes and stuff going on. But while that's happening, there's a massive storm that's taking place outside the school where Bastion is, where he's in the attic, and the windows are like bashing open, breezes coming in, it's storm, lightning, thunder, this and that. And I can't remember the exact measure of or the exact method on how it ended up transitioning to the part that I got completely stuck on, but they both, oh, that's right. So Bastion finally realizes what he has to do. So he's, but the way he sort of, I mean, how do I describe it? So he climbs up to the sort of rafters of the attic to close the window. Oh no, that's right. He goes out. Oh, sorry. I do apologize. He has to give her a new name.
Bastion.
Goes out on
Moonchild.
Moonchild. See, that's out of me, but I haven't read that book. But he goes out and he says it, and the rain stops, the thunder stops or slows down, and then everything goes into like complete darkness.
Do you notice that there's this is like the inversion of Abrahamic slash Christian theology?
That's what I took when it
Spoke
hit.
the word and the word was good, and he
Yeah.
spoke everything into existence, and then there was light. Well, he spoke the word, brought it into existence, and everything
Yeah.
was dark.
In the beginning, there was nothing.
In the yeah.
Yeah. It's really interesting how that sort of all interfolds, because that scene, like once that begun, like then I was getting real like Christian biblical passage going on like that, and the way it sort of played out. But that grain of sand, she opens her hand and gives him the grain of sand, and she, I'd have to,
And
God, I
that's
literally
the
made
grain of
piss.
sand is the seed of creation, right? And what do we
That's
see
right.
humans made of in a lot of mythology and even Christianity? Adam was created from dust, right? Dust of the earth. He was created
Yep.
by God. That Zeus created man out of clay. And what does he get given? The seed of creation, which is a speck of sand,
Yeah,
which
man.
in like the metaphysical and even the scientific, it talks about our universe being a speck of sand in the galaxy, or our galaxy being a speck of sand in the universe. We're
Yeah, dude.
so minute and small to the creation that's around us.
Oh, man, the film drove me wild. It drove me absolutely wild, dude.
Now, Fozzie, I've never actually partook of the devil's lettuce or any kind of drug. What do you think this would do to you if you were smoking a little bit of the ganja while watching this? Would it open up your mind more?
Well, I did,
Well,
and
hey,
it's I
there
did.
we go.
Don't it's all legal. I've got a prescription.
You got a prescription for this?
Yeah.
Where is it? Where's it? Where? Oh, where? Where? I should take your ass, dear. You know that?
Well, what?
For what? Look at this.
That's not my cigarette,
This
man.
cigar weed.
Well, it looked like a cigarette.
You better have glaucoma.
I do.
That glaucoma, my friend, huh?
Get away from me, Asia.
I mean, obviously, like when done right, it certainly opens up the senses to allow you to sort of maybe I wouldn't necessarily say like understand everything, but it gives you this sort of, how do I describe it?
See, this is why
It
I'm
gives you like
worried,
a
Fozzie.
multi def it gives you like a multi-dimensional sort of approach on how to sort of like analyze something. It's very, I mean, but how it affects me might not affect someone else the same way.
And this is what worries me, because not to toot my own horn, but I think I've gotten pretty good at seeing the symbolism from multiple cultures and universal aspects within
Yeah, dude.
films and cinema already, and that's me sober. I'm really worried that I'd be that one, like 0.01% guy who smokes marijuana and goes schizophrenic running down the street covered in
No, you'll call me and you'll be like, hey, I want to go to India. And I'll be like, done, let's go. Let's go. dude, it's look, the film was incredible, man. Like, so truly.
This
truly.
Is where it deviates from the book. So he gets the seed of creation from the Empress.
And he makes his wish.
He makes his wish.
Yep. Because she says, oh, that's just real quick. So when he said, when I came to this part in the film where I was like, oh, yeah, this is like manifestation. This is like reality. Yeah. She gives him the seed of creation, the grain of sand.
What is that? One grain of sand. It is all that remains of my vast empire. Fantasia has totally disappeared? Yes. Then everything's been in vain. No, it hasn't. Fantasia can arise in you. From your dreams and wishes, Bastion. How? Open your hand. What are you going to wish for? I don't know. Then there will be no Fantasia anymore. How many wishes do I get? As many as you want. And the more wishes you make, the more magnificent Fantasia will become.
Really?
And he said, what can I wish for? Anything you like, anything you want.
Yes.
And he goes, how many wishes do I get? As many as you want.
And this is ultimately the downfall of Bastion within the novel that you don't get to see in this film.
Elements
of it in the second film.
Okay.
So this is what I call all the power part of this book and the film, is that after Bastion gets this seed of creation from the Empress at the end of this film, Bastion basically turns into an anti-hero after going mad with power from all his desires, wishing himself to be the smartest, strongest, sexiest, most powerful, most influential person in the realm of existence. He self-deifies himself. This is the Gnostic idea of it. Man can become God. He does this. The book warns the readers directly through its meta loop of reading about Bastion, the dangers of escapism, dreaming, wishing fantasy, and wants. That you can literally lose yourself in desire and compassion for others is the only way that you can bring us out of that spiral of hedonism, which will never be satisfied. It's never satiated. Yeah. I think that's the difference that we see in Christianity versus Judaism.
Yeah.
We see that about the self putting others before yourself. It's really taking that ego out of it. It brings back a quote from Oscar Wilde for me that there are only two tragedies in life. One is not getting what one wants. One is not getting what one wants, and the other is getting it. So not getting it and then getting it. They are the two biggest tragedies in life.
God, dude.
Because the yearning of something and then getting it may not end up being what you wanted, or it can corrupt you by getting it.
Yeah.
Additionally, we see this idea of Bastion willing things into existence, like you said, through some form of power source, very much like a personification of manifestation. Essentially, that's what he's doing. He's manifesting.
Well, that's how Fantasia comes back into
being. Exactly,
right?
Yeah. So, which in itself can be likened to the energetic power practices of chi, orgone, or prana, which is an internalized energy to change one's body's energetic field, which in itself can alter the world around you.
100%, dude.
There's so much Eastern mysticism hidden in this film, but it's coupled with these elements of biblical scriptures of Christianity that I don't think Christians can really ignore for too long. I don't think it's demonic or evil to see these things that exist across multiple cultures and even within its own teachings. But we've kind of been led down this path of there's the Western understanding of what spiritualism and religion is as the faith, where I think Jesus himself actually taught a lot of those tenets, and it comes across in a lot of the parables of his word.
Of course. And he only had himself as a reference point for the people that didn't know. Like, if he was doing miracles, right, because he had learnt how to do these miracles, I mean, and this is whether this is through, whether this is through divine right, divine birth, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. My sort of Christian ethos subscribes more to like Arianism, and not Aryans. Obviously, the one like that sort of comes out of Egypt, and that came into being, in my opinion, probably earlier than any other church, because Jesus and Mary fled to Egypt. And whilst they were there, as if you, like Jesus for who he was, as if he's not going to go and like speak to people, like Mary's probably mum's in his fucking ear, just going, no, 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 like don't do this, don't do that, don't go out and see these people, blah, 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 blah,
he
blah.
He was the original tinfoil hat wearer. He spoke to everyone to just gain understanding of people, the 100%. World in which he existed.
And whatever he had said, whoever he had taught, unfortunately, I don't know if the information's there. From my understanding, the Nicene Council all agreed to like basically like completely annihilate all the works of Arius, who was the individual that I believe Jesus had actually like interacted with. And that was the initial inceptions of how Arianism came into being. But it was this idea that, because it was argued in because they got invited onto the council, and the discussion was, and the argument was against the discussion of like how to describe this, the new structure of like the Trinity. And the Arianists, and I believe this happened after Arius had passed away, this is like years later, had argued that Jesus can't be God, because if you're to infer that Jesus is God, Jesus has to be like omnipresent, has to be eternal. Like there can't be a birth and there can't be a death. He had to just come into being and he should have never died. That's the idea. But because Jesus did have a birth and did have a death, therefore he can't be God. But it doesn't mean that he can't emanate the qualities of God. It doesn't mean that he didn't have God-like essence. It didn't mean he even didn't have God-like behavior, walking on water, healing the blind, all these miracles that he did.
Which is
maybe quite... that is in itself that manifestation of willing something into being. You know, maybe he was just on a whole other different level, bro, that we have been suppressed to today because of microplastics and soy products.
It's very interesting because Druism and Islam tend to go along that. They say that Jesus is a prophet, and when he does return to become God, or to be the living God, to be Allah on earth, he actually had to go into the last stage of what a man's existence is to have a family. And because he didn't have a family on earth, he couldn't complete his cycle while he was here.
Dude, I've made a post on Twitter a month ago, maybe. I would, if there's anyone out there that listens to this that knows someone, or if you are, that knows someone that's a Druze, which is a religion that I believe is in Lebanon, and there is a diaspora, but they're very, very small. And they are like a combination. They're like quasi Hindu, Muslim, Jew, Christian, Buddhist, Jain, Sikh. They're like this weird amalgamation.
It's this weird idea they're trying to find source. And yeah, I don't care what religion you are.
Yeah.
You are looking for source and understanding source.
Absolutely. So if someone finds go, bro.
And the Druze are not my own personal cult where people have to wear red beards. That's not me at all. So I distance myself from that. It's just, yeah, like you said, it's this weird, almost an amalgamation of seeking to understand, which I think maybe a lot of people in the ancient world who were retelling this story and seeking to understand their place in reality and how we exist were kind of almost manifest, hate using that word, kind of found themselves, and it kind of brought itself into being in a lot of ways. And again, we have gone off track somewhat from the never ending story. We are back on the never ending conversation, but we are at the end.
We are at the end.
I'm going to go back to the idea of hedonism as self-discovery in this film. And this comes directly from a little bit of research about Andy, the author.
Yep.
So Andy understood that getting what we want can be a terrifying thing. In a land where the subconscious fills in the landscape, Bastian's lonely walk through the world is one of existential dread. And this is a quote from Andy himself. You wish for something, you've wanted it for years, and you're sure you want it. as long as you know you can't have it. But if it all at once looks as though your wish might come true, you suddenly find yourself wishing you had never wished for anything such as this from the Neverending Story. Bastion is lost in a lot of ways that mirror modern day people, especially the West. Depression is on the rise, mistrust is on the rise, social division is on the rise, national cohesion is plummeting. We're living in an era where many of us are pursuing what we want in life and losing ourselves like Bastion did. The ultimate lesson that kind of comes across as this is that Neverending Story is to learn how to be aware of oneself and a master of your own subconscious, to get to know your true self rather than your true will, what you want to happen, and to learn how to be happy by fulfilling the most basic needs first, that Maslow's hierarchy of needs, filling in the basics so that then you can fulfill your meaning, your purpose for those around you.
Yeah, wow. Sorry, Viv, you've left me a little bit speechless. That fuck off of that quote, man. But that was my takeaway from the film, like, to begin with, was that idea. And that's why, like, I made the tweet that I did, like, yeah, you know, this is idea that you can, and I'm going to push on you for a second.
Do it.
Don't be afraid to use the word manifest. I know it has a lot of, like, I know it sounds uber gay. Unfortunately,
you know, like those guys that live in Southern California, those SoCal guys. Oh, I'm just manifesting them my new promotion.
See, I blame like the hippies that do go to India, like that do these things. The ones that come back and they're like, oh, I'm opening up, you know, like a
fuck the Beatles, like a meditation those guys ruined studio. India for everyone.
Yeah. Oh man. But dude, like, you know, like, and you know, if you watch the film, you might think like what we're talking about is like, oh, well, is this stuff can happen in real time? Maybe. I don't know. But I think that, you know, as you said, if you do will it, if there is something that you want and there is something that you desire, that goal, that thing that drives you forward, some people might refer to it as destiny. Some people refer to it as dreams, whatever it might be. But that sort of end result, you want to be in a place in your life where you can be the best version of yourself. That idea sort of like stuck with me throughout that last scene. It stuck with, man. It's scene, bro, was. Oof.
I think a lot of Christians take away that idea as being almost, it's against God's plan, and God's plan is predetermined. You just have to take what happens as it comes. But that in itself is the same message. You can strive to be a better person. You can have goals. You can have ambitions. You can have things you want to do. As long as it's not a detriment to those around you and other people, you can try your damn hardest to achieve those things. If it doesn't happen, maybe that was God's will. Maybe it was never meant to be in your fate. Was it destined to not happen? Was it a part of your path? We don't know. We are merely mortals living in this physical realm, waiting for what the next answer is.
There's many paths. So in Hinduism, it's referred, I guess, like the term, like what you would say, I wouldn't be able to say this in Sanskrit, but the term would be like, there are many paths to moksha. There are many paths to that point where when you die, you have transcended, like you have lived the most truest of existence. You have lived the most holistic version of yourself. You have become the best version of yourself that you could possibly become because you have tapped into this. You've tapped into your consciousness. You know, you've tapped into that part of your being that allows, you know, sort of that, how would you describe it? That spirit to come in, you know?
Well, this is where the Book of John Paul is quite interesting, because he almost takes a Plato type of approach to the universe and consciousness. Is that and a lot of people hate this God consciousness, that if God is this omnipresent, omnipotent being that created everything, we are a part of that. We are a part, whether we know it or not, we are part of God's consciousness. We are interconnected. We are intertwined. It is a universal truth that we are connected to source. Christians will say we all have the divine spark in it. We have the sacred seed. We are part of God. Well, that's only a hop, skip, and a jump away from we share a consciousness with the universe and God in itself.
Like if the kingdom of heaven is, you know, the kingdom of heaven is within you, and that is a place of divinity, finding that divinity allows you to become something, it allows you to transcend what you are right now. I'm not saying like...
I think people take that the wrong way. They think that transcending is almost that Gnostic view that if you transcend to become bigger, better than what you are now, it's you trying to attain godlike status. I think it's trying to... And I'm no way agnostic, but I see a lot of the positives and a lot of the messaging they try to get across. I think there's an ancient Gnosticism, which was hijacked and inverted for nefarious purposes. But if you are trying to understand God, understand your place and your position within the world, and in some way becoming closer to Christ or to source or a connection to the universe, that's only a positive. There's no negative outcomes for that.
Yeah, it's, I think it's just like layered in as well with like that approach to life. Like if you're in, obviously everyone lives in societies these days, you know, sort of a given, but every single interaction you make, right, in my view, it truly matters for what you want to achieve in life. So you're obviously going to interact with people like what we're doing, yeah, or what anyone else is doing. It doesn't sort of matter how you behave in that environment. And it doesn't mean, you know, I can't drop the F-bomb. Like, I'm not going to go to hell for saying fuck. I'm not going to go, am I allowed to drop the C-bomb on this, or should I just avoid it altogether?
Go for it.
So if, you know, if you say
it's an Australian
word,
podcast, yeah, it's fair enough. Noun here.
Yeah, like if you drop the word cunt or fuck or shit or whatever.
Blasphemer!
And people go like, oh, don't swear. Like, bro, relax. You know, like, all will be fine. But if you're targeting that word at an individual,
the intention,
right? The sankalpa is what is referred to in Hinduism. But that intention you put into an action truly makes the difference for the outcome. And then that's layered into like karma and consequence and all these extra dimensional parts to the sort of, you know, greater whole of how you can be the best version of yourself. Bro, great film. Fuck, yeah. Such a good film.
And I'm going to finish this off with the negative flip on this, because I think there's a lot of positives hidden among the darkness there. It's that it doesn't exist in purely black or white. There's a lot of gray in there.
Yeah.
I think that's what kind of elements of this portray. But the curse theory, the really dark one I mentioned at the start. So this theory describes the shop owner as being the original cursed person. In the second film, The Neverending Story 2, The Next Chapter, he promptly leaves the town after he gives the book to Bastian.
Yeah.
He bails. Really? He's out of there. Really? He doesn't want to stick around, right? It's almost like Jumanji, where like when someone else gets the game, they bugger off.
Yeah.
It suggests that he did this because the curse was lifted off him, and once he placed it on Bastian's hands, who was so eager to escape before Bastian could return. Fantasia's residents asked Bastian for help because people had stopped dreaming, causing Fantasia to die. The book used the person's mind to keep itself from ending, which likely took a mental energy from the reader, feeding off our first character, the book owner, bookshop owner, and then Bastian. We can see that that man's quite old. We can see levels of depression in himself. He's literally getting his life force sucked out of him.
Yeah.
The previous reader, in this case, the shop owner, might have been completely drained at that point. And perhaps the never-ending story was ending because the aging shop owner ran out of energy for the book, which required him to become depressed over years of feeding of him.
Wow. I got to watch the second one.
There's a second one. There's a third one too.
Oh.
The second one, though, it tries to tie up those loose ends, like I said. And there's some funny parts where bullies try to take the book back off him and... Oh, this is in the third one, rather. Bullies try to take the book off him, however it goes. And a girl is helping him. A girl is now holding the book. His friend he's made at high school in his senior years. And everyone thinks he's an idiot because he's reading a children's book. And the bullies are beating the ever-living shit out of him. And she starts talking about things that are in her lexicon. Bastian started using moves like Bruce Lee and Van Damme combined. And then we see Bastian like doing roundhouse kicks and absolutely leveling these bullies.
Oh, no, really?
Though it got very kind of...
comical.
Late 90s comical.
Yeah.
Very pop culture-ish. The first film, super esoteric. The second one tries to tie up some loose ends, but really shows Bastion's descent into being the bad guy.
And the third one's Disney.
Third one is Disney. pretty much.
Damn.
The second one's good in the fact that it shows the drain of the book on Bastion.
Yeah.
There's a point where there's this evil character who wants to take over Fantasia, who doesn't have to trick Bastion. She just tells him to keep using wishes. Like, do it. It's your power. You know, you've got the seed of creation. You can do what you want.
Oh, and she boosting.
Puts him. She puts him in situations where he loses his intelligence and his brain power every time he wishes. Like, there's a scene where he's trying to escape, and instead of wishing for a staircase to escape, he wishes for each individual step because he's so driven by fear. Every single wish starts to drain his power and kill him, but he's doing every single step along the way.
That being that evil character in the second one, does that character in the second one get something that makes it stronger as it sort of like...
Every time he's losing himself, his memories are going to some kind of like storage thing. Almost like a library, like a library of Alexandria. Idea of all the information is going to a single source and she's feeding off it. She's like this sorceress type of a character.
Dude, I'm just getting like full Jin vibes.
Yeah, big time.
I'm just getting mad Jin vibes. And again, bro.
She's the inversion of the childlike empress, the moon child. She's this older woman, very dark, very powerful, whereas the moon child or the empress seems very young and very innocent but knowledgeable, whereas this one is just dark, really hammers it down.
Fuck. Had a few dark days, mate. Jeez. I'm going to have to watch it, man. I will watch it. That's crazy. I'm getting just that expression of like sort of the lexicon and storing that knowledge or those memories of Bastion's.
Dude,
I'm just getting like real, like I'm just getting real Jin vibes, like Solomon and like, yeah, bro. I think I've mentioned it before, like in the Quran, like describing the Jin like as the ones that were giving wishes, like to Solomon. To like give him these powers, you know, and like obviously on the other hand, like, you know, from the Talmud, describing Solomon as like having like godlike powers, like bringing things into being. Dude, what the fuck?
Dude, oh, man, her name is Zayid, Xayide. I'm quickly going to check the etymology on this.
Why does that remind me of Elon Musk's kid's name?
It does a little bit, doesn't it?
That's a bit weird.
Whoa, dude, it's. Anyone who hasn't seen this in a long time, you're an 80s baby, you're a 90s kid who hasn't seen it, you've got to go out and watch it because film, outside of the fun, loving, you know, believing in yourself kind of message that we get to kids, is so steeped in the metaphysical and the esoteric that I didn't realize how much it was until you kind of prompted me. Like, I've had this through my mind for years, but then you spoke about it, I'm like, oh, I've got to show him this side of things because there's the duality of it. There's the yin and the yang in this film.
Dude, I'm glad we had this discussion about it, man, because fuck, dude. The film, like, really, really got to me. Like, I didn't cry. I mean, like, there was definitely a moment where I was, like, starting to feel, like, a couple of butterflies tingling the top of my gut. But I tell you what, that second film, I reckon I'll enjoy it. I don't know if I'll enjoy it just as much as the first, but I certainly will enjoy it.
The name Zayid is
Zayid.
Zoroastrian in basis.
Sounds like it.
Wow. Means restless creative nature. So she's a restless evil character who wants the creative seed that Bastion has, and that's what she's after the whole time. If she can wipe his memory, she can control him and influence him to create what she wants.
I think Zayid is in Zoroastrian has some correlation to the summoning of spirits with fire ritual. I don't know if I haven't seen the second film.
There's a lot of fire symbolism in that one.
Is there really? Interesting. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, then I'll definitely enjoy it. Wow.
So there it was, mate. That was the never-ending story. Like we said, very esoteric, very symbolic. People need to go out and watch it. For the listeners who aren't aware of where they can follow you, Fozzie, where can they find your work?
They can find my work at Fozzie the Aussie. The Aussie is spelled spelled the whole thing. FOZZIETHEAUZZIE. So you can find me at Instagram, Twitter, or sorry, X, formerly Twitter, and YouTube. I did make a Rumble account. I haven't loaded any videos up yet. I've loaded up all my videos on YouTube now, but I haven't loaded them up on Rumble yet. But there is a Rumble account there, so I'll get to that. But that's pretty much where you can find me. I'm not on Facebook. I'm not, you know, Zuckerberg gets enough of me out of Instagram. I'm not giving him any more on Facebook.
He certainly does. Fozzie, this was an absolutely great conversation. It really took me back to my roots of podcasting, where I just jumped on with a mate and spoke about films. It came out of the blue. We had something else planned, but, you know, this was it, and I think it was a great episode. And we'll catch you next time, mate.
Yeah, done. Looking forward to it. See you, mate.
Hey, everybody. It's closing time. You don't gotta go home, but you can't stay here.